Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. Listen, this episode freaking rocks because our guest is Chris Voss. You know him. He's the world-renowned FBI negotiator, the author of Never Split the Difference. He has a super popular negotiation course on Masterclass you may have seen. And he's also, by the way, just released a new documentary on Amazon called Tactical Empathy. Check it out. Look, today we're going to cover the mindset, the skills, and the systems you need to be a better negotiator in your contracting business. Whether you're defending your price against a haggling client, you're driving a hard bargain with a supplier, or you're negotiating a comp package with a key employee, this episode will make you better. I hope you enjoy it.
You're listening to Contractor Evolution, where we unpack the systems, tactics, and skills you need to take your fast-growing contracting business to the next level.
If you're here to learn what it takes to scale up, work less, and increase profitability, you've come to the right place.
Stay tuned to learn what separates the new breed of contractor from the old school, and welcome to your ultimate guide on the business of contracting.
Chris, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you.
Thanks, man. Happy to be here.
I want to extend a very sincere, some gratitude at the beginning here. When we started the show 3 years ago, you were on my list of like dream state people to have, and we're finally here. So it's really an honor to get to talk to you today.
Well, congratulations on being up and running for 3 years.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
It is. You would know. It's a lot of work. Okay. Here's a nice, easy one to start. I'm sure that you've spent a lot of time, I mean, obviously writing, thinking, talking about negotiations your whole life, executing negotiations your whole life. I'm sure you've also just observed out there in the world how the average person does this. And so I have kind of an interesting question at the beginning. From your vantage point, when you're out there in conferences, in businesses, even just in your everyday life, can you describe how you observe most people negotiate?
Yeah, most people look at it as offer, counter offer, meet in the middle, haggling. You know, they don't see it as collaboration. They don't see it as navigation. They don't see it as communication. They don't see negotiation in and of itself as an information gathering process. They figure you gather information and then negotiate. They see that negotiation only, the commodity that indicates whether or not you're in a negotiation is if you're bargaining over money. And in point of fact, the real commodity is time. And as soon as you start thinking of negotiation as collaboration and as time, then it changes everything. Then it turns almost every conversation into a negotiation. There's a lot of stuff there. There's a lot.
What is that costing them? When you look at this very sort of narrow view of negotiation and sort of an underskilled approach to it, what is going through life that way costing them?
Time. I mean, it's death by a thousand cuts. It's increasing friction on a regular basis. And that's why the improvements are not that noticeable. They're not huge leaps. But if you start realizing that you want to remove the friction as opposed to, you know, increasing the gain, and your life starts to jump forward really quickly in really subtle ways. It's, you know, it's kind of like working out. You don't get one day of working out, you don't get that much of an improvement. You say, I'm not going to work out anymore. But if you stay with it, you know, a month later, 2 weeks later, actually, suddenly things are going much more smoothly. And so there's almost an invisible transition in it. So it's the elimination of unnecessary friction that we think just goes with the territory of human interaction. It just doesn't. Mm.
You had mentioned something interesting, and it was like, it's right in my prep. You sort of said most people think of this as haggling over price. And I wrote that down to kind of ask you a question about this. I think that most people, when they think of the word negotiation and sort of the semantics behind it, the meaning behind it, what if we were to define it, what would the average person say? I think they'd sort of just say haggling over price, or they can think right of some moment in a pawn shop or a flea market where they're kind right of bartering for something. That's a very narrow sliver of what I think is a much broader picture and concept. So can you, Chris, just like broaden our definition of what negotiation means?
At great collaboration. is what and navigation. I mean, how do we collaboratively navigate the minefield, the obstacles? You know, if you're in a negotiation with somebody, you've got a shared problem. You've got two different aspects of the same problem. It's problem solving. You want to get something, they want to get something. The two of you are actually trying to solve a problem together. And when you realize that, then it completely changes the complexion of what you're doing. The other person on the other side is not the adversary. The adversary is a situation. You know, collaboratively, can we get together and come up with a better solution? And, you know, it's hard to imagine because it's easier to count money. And it's easier to say, you know, I've never lost money on a deal I didn't make. Well, yeah, you did, because your time was worth something. And there was a cost in time. That's your ultimate commodity. Time is the ultimate commodity. I mean, you get compensation for your time in dollars or how long it takes you to stand in line or whether or not you get a late checkout at the hotel. Or, you know, whether or not you get an upgrade to a suite at a hotel. We got a whole system. Like I get a free upgrade to a suite in a hotel every time I ask if they have it. Because whether or not they give you the free upgrade is first, for them, it's an inventory issue. They can't give you what they don't have. Secondly, they gotta have a margin. Like if you're gonna be there one night, you're the last guy in. You know, I'm often checking in late, and I'm getting in 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, and I'm out the next day. They got one suite, they can give it to me because they're probably not gonna sell it that night as an inventory issue. You know, they're gonna roll the dice, and you know what's the commodity I offer them in return? You know, social media post. Some sort of, there's a lot of invaluable rating stuff that they want to have. And so that's good for them. Now, if I'm in there for four nights and they got one suite, they're probably not going to give it to me because somebody's going to come in, probably want to sell that, they're going to sell that commodity to somebody else. So first, it's an inventory issue. Secondly, do they feel like giving it to me? You know, never be mean to somebody who could hurt you by doing nothing. All right, wow. Almost everybody you talk to can say, there's nothing I could do. If you're talking to them for collaboration, how often does somebody say, you know, it is what it is. There's nothing I could do to help you. Well, does a person behind the counter feel like giving me that suite? I'm working on an upgrade to a room in a hotel in New York, probably 2 years ago. And they can't give it to me that night, and there's an air conditioning problem in my room. I go back down the next day to try to solve it. But the way I asked for the suite the day before, the guy appreciated so much how nice it was to me, how nice I was to him, instead of, you know, feeling like I beat him up. I'm a platinum member of your guys' hotel. You know, I'm entitled to this, you know. They ain't never going to give it to you. I come back the next day. And they actually pull a room out of a block for a wedding party and give it to me.
Amazing.
And because of the way I treated them, never be mean to somebody who could hurt you by doing nothing. The duration of your stay there, it's going to have an impact. You're probably going to come back to the front desk. When I ask for a suite and they don't give it to me, first of all, I know for sure they don't have it because I could tell by the way they check. They look at me right, if they look at you right away and say, you know, we don't have anything, they didn't check. I'm watching a person, and if they go, oh, wait a minute, let me look. And if you could tell they're going through the computer, they're checking the inventory. So if I don't get it, I'm probably going to be back to the front desk sometime in my stay and need something else. I need to leave early. I need a late checkout. I got an air conditioning problem in my room. There's a million things you're going to want. So none of these are price issues. These are all collaboration issues. Did they feel like cooperating with me? When I made my ask, were they offended? Or were they disappointed that they couldn't give it to me right, if they didn't have it? You know, but then I'm looking at the relationship, not as transactional in a moment, but I'm looking at, I need ongoing collaboration. And you need ongoing collaboration from everybody in your life. You know, I'll jump to another example. one of the students in my class at Georgetown implements a bargaining system in my book, Never Split the Difference. Towards the end, there is a chapter on hard bare-knuckle bargaining. It's the Ackerman system. And if you kick the system into gear, you're going to get the best price every time. Now, the problem with that is, if you beat them down to the rock bottom price where you've taken away their margin, when you come back, how collaborative are they going to be? So my student goes into Home Depot and just kills them on a price for cabinets, just kills them. And comes back later on because there's a problem with installation. And they remember that they got killed on a price.
How helpful are they going to be?
They are not lifting a finger to go out of their way to help this guy fix anything. So, yeah, you could haggle and get the last dime on the table. And when you come back, you're going to pay the price long term.
I want to get into this a little later on. I want to get into the Ackerman model. But I want to ask you this earlier on. You know, I think we can talk about tactical stuff and skills to learn and best practices to follow, and we will. I also think that there's kind of a mindset piece to this. And I get the sense, because I've experienced this in my own life. Forget about the skills. If you don't actually have... Is it the courage? Is it the confidence? It's maybe a belief system around negotiating versus not negotiating. I think that there are many people, maybe Chris, you know what the percentage is, who go through their entire life just saying, I can't negotiate, I can't bargain, I can't make the ask because I don't want to make them uncomfortable, and then it's awkward and blah, blah, blah. So is there anything you can, any advice you can offer to help people kind of like make that first initial step and even just open up their mindset to this whole way of doing business and way of doing life?
Yeah, well, there's kind of two basic mindsets that hold people back from negotiating. And it has to do with what your conflict type is. We believe very strongly, I've got enough anecdotal evidence to back it up, that the world splits pretty evenly into thirds, regardless of gender, ethnicity, geography, religion, anything. And it's fight, flight, make friends, assertive analyst and accommodator. Now, the assertive loves negotiating, loves hard bargaining tactics, and is not afraid of it, and looks forward to it and sees negotiation as combat. So that doesn't they're not really held back that much unless in a moment they just don't feel like going to war. And then you won't negotiate because you see it as combat, and you know you don't have the energy for it. You don't want to fight the person on the other side of the table. An assertion is necessary. Now, the two that are really, the most reluctant, the analyst and the accommodator. The analyst is conflict avoidant. They see it as highly inefficient. And because the assertive is always in combat, almost everybody pictures the assertive on the other side of the table. You're the Donald Trumps of the world.
Right.
I don't feel like going toe-to-toe with Donald Trump today. And it's highly inefficient. I'm just not going to do it. So they'll hold themselves back because they don't like the combat. And if you look at it as collaboration, and then also you need to take a step to get information, the analyst really wants to have all the information before they make up their mind, and they don't see negotiation as an information gathering process. So, you know, how can you stick your toe in the water? Because you need that information. How can you open the conversation without it being combat? So that it's information gathering process. If you can take that point of view, because that's what's holding you back, but you need that information. So think about what's the tiniest step I could take to engage in a process, because I need that data. I need to know what their range is. I need to know how they see this. I need to know if it's long term. Take the smallest, tiniest step. If you're highly analytical in nature, you're not engaging in conflict. But you're gathering information. And that's the thing that holds the analyst back the most. Now, the accommodator, the make friends type, they're really afraid to, quote, negotiate. Because, again, they see it as combat. They don't want to offend the other side. Like, if I engage in negotiation, you know, I don't like it. It's, you know, it's what the golden rule, how the golden rule holds us back. You know, don't treat people the way, only treat them the way you want to be treated. Well, the accommodator doesn't want combat. And so I'm not going to engage in negotiation because I don't want that done to me. Well, negotiation is also a relationship building process. People love to feel heard. It strengthens the relationship. So if you look at negotiation as the relationship building, information gathering, they're going to love giving you information. Then you kind of stick your toe in the water there too and engage in a process to develop a better relationship, because people love feeling the feeling of being heard. It's a very deeply wired feeling that everybody responds to, everybody. Everybody wants to be heard. And so if you engage in a process, that's a way to eliminate that fear. You're not hurting the other side. You're not attacking them. They actually like you more if they feel heard by you.
This is a perfect little jumping off point to dive into an idea from the book that I love and I try to deploy in my life, which is tactical empathy. And I wonder if just before I ask the follow-up questions, just kind of give us a lay of the land on this whole concept and where it fits into the negotiation.
Yeah, let's break it. Let's break each word out a little bit to clear some things up. Empathy has become synonymous with sympathy. And it was not originally designed and intended that way. Empathy is strictly understanding where the other side's coming from. It's not agreeing, it's not disagreeing. You know, the reason that I first started collaborating with the Harvard guys, because Bob Mnookin, the head of the program on negotiation, wrote a book called Beyond Winning. And I think it's the second chapter in the book. It's the best chapter on empathy I've ever read. Even, you know, it's better than what's in Never Split the Difference. When people come on to my team, I have them read this chapter and I quiz them on it to make sure that they understand it. And the reason I collaborated with Harvard and Professor Mnookin from the beginning, because he said empathy is not about agreeing with the other side. It's not even liking them. Empathy is just understanding where they're coming from. Right. And so if you can define it that narrowly, someone from Hamas can use empathy with someone from Israel.
Right.
And vice versa. It's stating what the other side's understanding, where the other side's coming from, not agreeing with it, not even liking it. Now, the important next step to make it tactical is you got to utter it. You got to say it out loud. And that's what really scares a lot of people. They think empathy is, all right, if I understand where you're coming from, I can make a better argument. Well, you left out the middle part, the demonstration of understanding. Nobody ever felt heard. If you make a better argument, if you say, this is what you believe, you think this. When I was working terrorism in New York City in a joint terrorist task force, I talked to a Muslim who was a legit Muslim. I mean, they believed in a religion. They followed the practices there in the United States because they're sending money back to their family someplace in the Middle East. You know, they're not radicals. You know, they're just genuinely following the religion. And I'd say to them, you believe that there's been a succession of American governments for the past 200 years that's been anti-Islamic. And they go, yeah, that's right. Now, I never said it was true. I said, you believe.
Right.
And I also never followed up with, but that's not true because we got a First Amendment guaranteeing freedom of religion, you know, all the explanation.
Right.
Just articulating what their perspective is the tactical aspect of it. And, you know, I never said I agreed.
Yeah.
I started out with, you believe.
There's something about empathy. I like how you said people are mixing it up with sympathy. There's something about empathy as a fundamental idea that is somewhat emotionless. It's much more cerebral. It's much more like mental. It's like I can put myself cognitively, visually in your shoes so that I understand the framing, the perspective, the lens that you're looking through. But I'm not animated. I'm not upset. I'm not excited. I'm just, it's a very like cerebral exercise of going there. And that's a very, I think, an important distinction. It's obviously helpful to sympathize with someone or you know, feel their pain to some extent. But this is, I think, what you mean when you say in the book, like, I think you frame it like, don't feel their pain, label it. That's a distinction.
Yeah, very well said. It's really analytical.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Sam Harris might have been in an interview with Lex Fridman. I think he said empathy is a species of reason.
Right.
And I thought, ooh.
That's catchy.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It is highly analytical. You got to think. Empathy requires thinking.
So where does it fit in and really offer us utility in a negotiation, this tactical empathy idea?
Well, at all indicators. Like even if I'm engaged in harm bargaining, I'm going to use a lot of empathy with you because you're taking positions based on last century Newtonian thinking. You know, what's Newtonian thinking? It's the way we thought about physics before Einstein came around and told us that everything was wrong.
Right.
So empathy gets people out of that thinking. It increases trust. I mean, it's the application of it is universal, and I'm using it all the time. I'm using it before I make a hard ask. I'm using it as a response to your hard ask. I'm using it to clear your head. I'm using it to demonstrate that I want to collaborate with you over a long-term time frame because we'll both make more money if we do.
Right. Do you have practical steps to get better at it? Like for someone who understands this conceptually and they want to actually implement it into the way that they do deals, the way that they sell, the way that they work with vendors and other partners – How does someone who's maybe not the best at this actually get better at it?
Yeah, well, anybody can, first of all. It's not a natural skill, it's a learned skill. And you start putting in your time in the simple practices, just like anything else, just like any sport, just like any other behavior. You know, the tiny little practices. What are those tiny little practices? Here's a great hack. Stop saying, "How are you today?" to the people that you agree. Take a read based on the information you're getting off the look of their face, the expression on their face, their body language, and do what we call a cold read. Seems like you're having a good day. If they look happy, if they look distracted, seem like there's some a lot on your mind today. If they look sad, seems like it's been a tough day. Do a genuine read on what you see. Now, you don't got to be accurate. They're going to feel seen. I do this on a regular basis when I'm on an airport every other day. So the TSA guys in my practice, you know, I'm rolling through TSA a couple of months ago, and I realized I forgot to hit up the first guy. So I'm waiting for my bag to come out. And there's a TSA dude standing there where the bags come out. And I go, and he just got kind of a medium expression on his face. But I go, seems like it's been a tough day. And that was not the data on his face. I was just being a little bit lazy. and he kind of got, you know, his reaction was like, "Nah, that's not it." And I went, "Nah, just another day, huh?" And he goes, "Yeah." And he brightened up. I was getting in practice. As it turned out, because you got to stay loose. Jim Camp, who wrote the book Start With No, called Negotiation a Human Performance Event. So you never know when somebody's going to throw you the ball. You got to stay loose. With this read I did of this guy at TSA, as it turns out, a guy that I've been trying to get a hold of for over a week hits my cell phone out of the blue while I'm 10 minutes later while I'm sitting down having a cup of coffee. Because I had stayed loose on my reads. My emotional intelligence, my observational skills of emotions. When he called, I was dialed in and I was ready. Normally, I don't do spontaneous conversations. I want to be focused. I don't do important conversations when I'm driving. I want to be sitting still and I want you to have my full attention. I would not have done this if I was not having trouble getting this guy on the phone. But because just in my day-to-day reads, I was ready, we had a great conversation.
I love that whole, this idea of What did you call it? A cold open or a it's not saying how are you. It's actually making an attempt to read their body language, their facial expression, and then offer that for them. And it's also like, I think the point you made is really good. It's like, it doesn't actually matter that you're right. It matters that you tried, I think, to the receiver. They're like, okay, maybe he's like saw the wrong side of my face, or I made a weird expression randomly. Here's how I'm actually doing. But you can you just think about that sort of just think about that mentally for a second. Like it's very obvious why that or how that works in the broader context of this conversation that we're having. I don't want to move off of this point before I ask you. On a psychological, emotional, this sounds kind of woo-woo, but even on a spiritual level, why is this so important in the context of collaborative negotiation, this tactical empathy piece?
Well, it's probably important on a couple of reasons. The first is my co-author, one of my co-authors of the book, Never Split the Difference, Tal Roz is a writer. My son Brandon collaborated fully in it. He's an uncredited co-author. The Tal, while we're working on it, contended that we're all wired to collaborate based on the ancestors that survived. You know, the caveman that didn't collaborate died alone in the dark because nobody was there to save him. Mm-hmm. So we have an innate instinctive wiring to want to collaborate if we can overcome our fears. So collaborative negotiation appeals to us in a very deep way, in deep down our survival instincts. You know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you will. First issue is, are we going to survive? You know, that resonates very deeply with people. And then because of that, like this, the sense of being heard, what good is that? Well, before the book came out, we didn't have a lot of neuroscience. We got a lot more neuroscience now collectively. I'm listening to podcasts on neuroscience all the time. Andrew Huberman is probably my favorite. If people feel understood, they get a dose of oxytocin and serotonin. What does oxytocin do? And this is a neurochemical. This ain't psychology. This is a hard science and neuroscience. When your oxytocin internally is triggered, you bond with me and you're more inclined to be honest with me. And so you feel understood, you're bonding with me, you're more honest with me. Awesome. This is exactly what I need for a negotiation. Now, the other neurochemical you get ahead of is serotonin. Serotonin is a drug of satisfaction. What does that mean? What that means is you want less. So if I can get you to feel understood, you bond with me, you're more honest with me, you're less demanding. That's a pretty good way to continue into a negotiation.
That is a science-backed way of saying it just softens people. And it sort of lubricates the whole conversation for us in a way that is not only easier and nicer to experience, but if we want to go back to sort of a strategic level, it is advantageous to have that, you know, to have someone in the palm of your hand. Maybe that's a hyperbolic way of saying it. But anyone who's done any amount of selling, and all of our listeners have, will know when they're really on their game and they're listening to a customer talk about their needs and the experience they had with the last contractor that they hired and really what they're looking for on this project. And instead of just scribbling some notes down and going, yeah, I got it, you slow down and you actively listen and you nod your head and you mirror and you can make a few comments about how you felt an experience like that before, and you summarize what you hear them say to make sure that you're getting it right. You kind of follow all the typical active listening steps. You will know, like, your odds of closing that deal go up orders of magnitude, not a fraction. Like, you are way more likely of landing that deal and having that customer be a really great customer later on. When you go to produce the work, they're going to be your rapport is there, your trust is there. So I think people get this on a very in a lived experience way. But I wanted you to explain the neuroscience behind it, and I find that really, really fascinating, the serotonin and the oxytocin part. I want to move on to another thing in the book, and I've heard you speak about this from stage, Chris. It's this idea of creating the illusion of control. And so before we kind of pick this apart, maybe you can just unpack the concept of control in this whole negotiation thing. Why is that something you talk about so much?
Yeah, you know, the secret to gaining the upper hand in negotiation is giving the other side the illusion of control. A lot of people feel they got to be in control, especially the assertives. And, you know, they're tightly wound. You know, I gotta talk to stay in control. So deference works great on assertives. Mm. There's great power in deference. To start off with, you know, the deferential approach. Like, it's amazing what you can get away with saying if you're deferential. Like, it, you know, if I was working for Donald Trump, if I was deferential to him, and I don't need to stroke his ego, I just need to be deferential to him to get him to collaborate. You know, it's one of the reasons why I'm convinced that his son-in-law, Jared, has done so well with him extraordinarily over the years. Mm. You know, they ain't fighting in public, and Jared is, when he worked in the last administration, got things done for him, did extraordinary things for him. You know, it's just a great collaboration, and I'm convinced that it's deference, not ego stroking. Mm. So there's great power in deference. And then how do you really convey it? How do you get it across to the other side? Well, it's really why we teach the calibrated questions that start with the words what and how. Because people love to be asked what to do. Mm. And people love to be asked how to do it.
Say a little bit more about these calibrated questions.
Well, it's the short, very shortened list of what we think of as open-ended questions, or some people refer to them as interrogatives or the reporter's questions, who, what, when, where, how, why. I think I nailed most of them. Why is an accusatory question. If I asked you, why'd you wear that shirt? Your first thought is,
that's true.
What's wrong with my shirt?
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that.
I like it.
Yeah.
You know, how dare you?
Yeah.
And of that list, why is probably the most damaging? Because we're taught to ask it all the time. You know, there's a book out there, Find Out Their Why. Now, you need to find out their why. But if you ask them why, they feel accused. They feel like they did something wrong. And in point of fact, on a regular basis, if you're interacting with someone who's done something that you think was wrong, you're going to ask them why they did it. And, you know, my boss comes up to me and says, you know, why'd I do this? I'm like, I think I'm in trouble. My spouse says, why'd you do that? I think I'm in trouble. Heck, if my kids say to me, why'd you do that? I think I'm in trouble.
This is such
and I'm mad at them.
Chris, I've never thought of this. You're totally right. I'm thinking of just like, in the context of being a leader, let's say you have an employee who makes a screw up. If you say, why did you do this versus, can you help me? Can you just help explain how this happened? Like those two examples, those feel different when you say it out loud, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Or even if in those terms, if you just switch your why to a what, you ask the person that, you know, what caused you to do that? Suddenly they're like, oh, it takes the sting of accusation out. Mm. So, and the whole point is to take the sting of accusation out. So that's, you know, you got to be careful with why. So let's cross that off our list in general terms to start with. And so then what is a question that feels very deferential and it's primarily designed to uncover problems? What's the biggest challenge you face? What keeps you up at night? What happened last time you tried this? Mm. It's primarily, not exclusively, a great design to uncover a problem. Now, versus how is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily designed to create implementation. How would you like to proceed? The book starts with a story, how am I supposed to do that? Mm-hmm. Which I originally learned as a way to start saying no. And Brandon referred to that as forced empathy, makes the other side take a look at your situation and see the difficulty. Now, how they respond to that is going to tell you who you're dealing with.
Right.
How am I supposed to do that is 8 out of 10 times totally game changes the negotiation. Like, it's more people have picked up, how am I supposed to do that as a magic wand phrase than anything else. Now, if I could run down this rabbit hole of how am I supposed to do that for just a second.
Please.
every now and then, somebody says, I tried how am I supposed to do that and it didn't work. And I'm like, what do you mean? I say, I don't care. You just got to do it. Like I one top level executive dealing with a deal that's several hundred million dollars, the counterpart said, I don't care what happens to you. I don't care if you get fired. I don't care if you lose your job. And he says, how am I supposed to do that? Didn't work. No, it's not that it didn't work. It told you who the other side was.
Right.
It was an answer you didn't expect because it worked so well the other eight times you tried it. Like it was a game changer. They suddenly changed everything. They cut their ask in half because they knew they were coming in too high. But how am I supposed to do that? I first learned that as a first way to say no, but it's really an implementation question. Mm. You're asking for the other side, saying like, look, if you could show me how I could implement this, I'd be happy to do it. It's immediately collaborative. It immediately makes the other side 8 out of 10 times, not 10 out of 10, 8 out of 10, which is more than anything else, by the way. It immediately gets them to take into account your implementation issues and work with you on them. So how is really about implementation?
So we remove why from our negotiation vocabulary and we use what and we use how a little more liberally.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you explain how, no pun intended, this creates this feeling or this illusion of control in the other people? Connect the dots for us. I get what you're saying about calibrated questions, and I understand conceptually how control is an important thing to make someone feel, but can you just sort of like close the loop for us and explain how using calibrated questions like this delivers that for us in a negotiation?
Well, it makes me feel really good to tell you how to do something.
Because people like to do that.
People love it. People, you know, I feel like I'm mentoring you. You know, I feel like I'm the sage. I'm the adult. You know, I'm the wise one that you come to for advice. It just feels really good to be able to mentor somebody. And when you're mentoring them, you're no longer an adversary. You're guiding them. You're helping them. You're on their side. You want them to succeed. If you can trigger somebody into mentoring you, you now are in collaboration. And now they have a vested interest in seeing their guidance succeed. So they will be on your side a little bit more. They'll clear some obstacles. Because if I ask you how to do something and then I do it and I fail, following your guidance, you fail.
So,
and you don't want that.
It's like in life when people, I think if we all put ourselves, I mean, go back to a memory when someone has come up to you and said, hey, I really want your advice on something. You can't help but feel a little kind of like dopamine hit there. Like there's a little ego thing that I was like, oh, like I'm, my thoughts are in demand. Like I'm a pretty important person all of a sudden. So, like, is it really that simple? You're kind of tapping into that little ego thing. And by the way, the ego loves to be in control. So that's kind of the connection.
Yeah, it absolutely is 1,000%. I mean, I think it to some degree, you know, there's a lot of sales advice where they say, ask for help. You know, I need your help on this. And I think probably that was good when it first started. I think it's been overused. I think it's been weaponized a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that are not genuinely looking to collaborate with me have picked up on that. And now, consequently, when somebody comes to me right off the bat saying, I need your help, I'm like, oh, okay. Well, about 7 out of 10 times, you're looking to pick my pocket. That's a high enough percentage that I'm instantly leery of you. Now I'll proceed with you. I'll test you a little bit. But you've just given me a real indicator that you're trying to hustle me. So we don't tell people to ask for help. Now, there's a way to trigger that feeling to see if the other side's going to be collaborative. You know, and the how question is, it runs right down there, you know, avoiding this hot button word that's been weaponized against me of help.
You talk in this section too, I think that these ideas are connected, mirroring and labeling, and how do those help, again, like just reinforce that feeling of that illusion of control?
Well, those are two very different skills. And I find, you know, it's like right hand and left hand. We find most people, like, you have a preference either for labeling or for mirroring, and then you got to train yourself to use the other one. Mm-hmm. Now, mirroring is just a repetition of 1 to 3 of the last 3 words you just said. It's simple. It doesn't require any of the analysis that we talked about before, that doing a cold read. The cold read's a label, you know, slapping a label on the emotion that you think you see. So a label could be the emotion or the dynamic you see or you hear. And it's very observational in nature. It requires a slight amount of analysis. I happen to love labels. Most of the people on my coaching staff, and I got some superstars, most of us love labels because we can adapt them. It's a Swiss Army knife of negotiations. I can work my way through an entire negotiation with a label. Mm. Now, the interesting breed of cat is a guy who loves the mirror. It's just a repetition of the last 1 to 3 words. You know, that's a different skill. That's the opposite hand. And that makes people, it confirms that you've been heard in a different way. If I label what, or if I mirror what you just said, without question, I heard the words because I repeated them. Mm. And it triggers the recipient's brain in a different way. You'll expand, you'll explain, you'll change the words up. It's so much better than "what did you mean by that?" or "tell me more about that." You know, if you say, you know, I find negotiation fascinating. And if I say to you, "what do you mean by fascinating?" You're probably going to say, "fascinating. Don't you know what the word fascinating means?" You know, you repeat the same word, only louder.
Right.
Like an American overseas looking for directions. Where's the Eiffel Tower?
So mirroring, just to be clear, is sort of, you're saying repeat the last 1 to 3 words that someone said, whereas labeling right. is sort of trying to use that tactical empathy to describe the feelings that they have or the situation that they're in?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, very well said. Let me give a parent teenager example. Kid comes home, mom and dad trying to trigger the kid. "How was your day?" How question. Mm. Kid's been asked that 1,000 times. Parent used to the parent proceeding immediately to the next question, "what did you learn?" So, which is, if you proceed immediately to the next question, you don't feel listened to. So what do the kids always say? "I forget. How was your day?" "I don't know. I forget. I don't know. Forget." The mirror would be, "you forget?" Now, parents are opening up kids right and left, which is mirroring that. Because the kid suddenly feels there was some hearing. Mm. Now, the label to that would be, sounds like they had a lot to it. Because there was so much that going through it is exhausting. It was a lot there. So sounds like a day had a lot. Sounds like a day was frustrating. Sounds like you just as soon forget that day. That'd be the label.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, powerful distinction between those two. And neither of them are particularly hard. I mean, that's something that I really like about a lot of your work is this stuff is highly implementable. And I would say it's quick to learn. It takes probably a lifetime to master. But none of this stuff is incredibly complex. It's just sort of like things that we're not doing because we're moving too quickly and we want to, you know, we're listening for the moment where we get to talk versus listening to hear what they're actually understanding. But the exactly. essence of a lot of the stuff you're sharing is none of it is particularly complex or difficult to grasp. We just don't do it. I want to ask, so this driving a hard bargain part, there is a whole section in the book devoted to it. And you had mentioned earlier the Ackerman model. Now, I also understand this probably isn't to be abused and used in every single situation, but there are certain contexts when it is needed. So can you maybe talk a little bit about driving a hard bargain broadly and then the Ackerman model more specifically?
Yeah, well, you may find yourself in a position where you need to drive a hard bargain. You know, bare knuckle bargaining comes up. Maybe, I don't know, sometimes it's unavoidable. And what you really need is as much application of tactical empathy as possible so that it feels less like a battle. Because if you're bargaining with someone and it goes well, you're going to want to do business with them again.
Right.
You know, and I got a brand new house where I live. I just bought a few months ago. We get contractors coming in and out of here doing stuff for us. And contractors on a regular basis are taught to ask for way more than they need because, you know, they're used to this offer, counteroffer, meet in the middle nonsense. I don't have time to explain tactical empathy to them. So they're going to bargain with me. Now, I want to get a good price. I want to feel, I want to bring the number down because I know they asked for more than what they wanted because that's what they were taught. I don't want to kill them and I don't want to make them feel beat up over it. So I'm going to use a lot of empathy. You know, I know you work really hard. I know the work that you do is very valuable. You know, I know this is going to look magnificent when it's done. I know you're going to go through a lot to get this implemented. I know you got to work really hard. That's empathy. That's just recognition of what they're going through. And then at some point, I'm going to start with how am I supposed to do that? Look to bring the price down. Now, if I need to, I got a number I'm going to throw out, and it's going to be low if I got a bargain. Because your sense of accomplishment on the final number is going to be driven like not what your starting price was, but where mine was and how you got me there.
Right.
That's your sense of accomplishment. And then if we go through several bargaining phases, and we will, I need to increase my offers or change my position by decreasing increments. And I got to be cautious about making any big leaps unexpectedly. So the Ackerman model is based on a series of decreasing increments. Like if I make a 20% move, my next offer, if I make it, it's got to be half that, 10%.
Yeah.
And if I make another offer after that, it's got to be half that, 5%. Because each time you drag me another distance, that distance has to be less because you're going to feel like you're getting everything you can. So there's a separate issue of did you get everything you can or did you feel like it? Now, you may have gotten everything out of me that I had, but if I didn't make you feel like you got it all, and that's where you got to be careful making too big unexpected jumps. A number of years ago, where I'm living in D.C., we're involved. We're in the middle of this, the development of the D.C. waterfront. I happen to remember, you know, I had a boat. I lived on a boat. I was a member of Capital Yacht Club. We're dead set in the center of this. And as a very small player, we're negotiating with the developer. In good faith. And we pushed them right up to the very end. And just before they cut the deal, they made $1 million jump in their offer. And I'm convinced that we tapped out them to their very to their limit. However, that $1 million jump was so big and so unexpected, it scared the hell out of the majority of the people on my side of the table, like, oh my God, we didn't think they had that much room. If they have that much room left,
what are we
how much
doing?
More do they have?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I'm trying to say, like, no, we've done a really good job here. We got a good faith offer. They have gone to their limit. And that jump just scared everybody so badly. It's a human nature aspect. You got to be careful about the jumps that you make because if it rattles the other side enough, it indicates you got a much deeper pocket than you may have.
The way that I like in the book, to correct me if these percentages are wrong, but I think the way that it's described is in a negotiation, like beforehand, you get really clear on what your desired price is, and your initial offer is around 65%. Your next right. offer is 85%. And the offer after that is 95%. So if you're talking about sort of this, like the descending intervals, 85 to 65 is a other way around, 20% move, 85 to 95 is a 10% move, 90 to 95 is a 5% move. And so you're subliminally signaling sort of the way like an asymptote looks on a graph is like, hey, I'm getting closer to the limit without saying what your limit is. And right. I'm not going to go over that. And so that's sort of like the power in doing that. And I just like practical, simple frameworks. I mean, maybe you can fudge the numbers a little bit for your context, but generally speaking, decide on the price, start at 65, move to 85 and then 95. And then you're going to be pretty close to the territory where you're ready to make a handshake, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And two things that you did a great job pointing out, the decreasing incremental changes. And then with enough empathy, a number of years ago, we're coaching JetBlue in their procurement section. And, you know, they come in at 65, they're prepared to go to the 100% mark. And they use so much empathy that they cut the deal at 85%. You're like, holy cow.
That's not what I meant. Yeah. Yeah.
But, and that's a critical aspect that most people are not used to in bargaining. They're not used to having any empathy or understanding it. They're used to it being a game of chess or tic-tac-toe. I move, you move, I move, you move, I move, you move. No demonstration of understanding of where the other side's coming from, appreciation, gratitude. And as soon as you drop those things into a negotiation, like it's a game changer.
Yeah.
You know, what do I mean by gratitude? You could put gratitude in every negotiation because the other side's made an offer. And I love it when they say we're making a generous offer. The subliminal aspect of that is they've worked really hard on it. Mm. And especially if you're going to reject it. And if you counteroffer, that's a rejection. So what's the gratitude? Like, and I say, look, I appreciate the fact that you guys have worked really hard on this. I know that you've gotten together a lot. You've worked on this as a team. You've considered a lot of different options of what you were going to put forward. And you guys put a lot of effort into this offer. And I want you to know I appreciate it. And then I shut up. And I love doing this, especially if we got people on a Zoom, because you can see across the board the looks of relief on people's faces. Mm. Like they, you know, you're just being genuine. You're observing a dynamic you know to be the case. And you're just saying, look, I appreciate the amount of hard work you guys have put into this. And they have. And that's going to move you much closer to a deal that they're gonna want to do again, because instead of feeling beat up in a process, they kind of like the process.
I want to flip this around. What about a situation, and this is one that our listeners will find themselves in all the time. In fact, you just alluded to it in your own life. They're a contractor. They build homes. They renovate homes. They install roofs. They do beautiful landscapes and retaining walls, whatever. They are going to be in situations many times a year, in fact, in some cases, many times a month, where a customer, like you were, is trying to negotiate them down off of their price. So let's just do this in the inverse. What is your advice to someone who is basically trying to defend downward pressure on their price that they want? We are taught, there's a lot of people in the contractor, in the sort of like this influencer business advising space, who will just say, never negotiate, never drop your price, never do anything, which I think is a little simplistic. There are certain contexts when you kind of need to. But what's the best way to sort of play defense and get the most for the service that you provide when you're getting that pressure from a potential customer? One that you want, by the way. This isn't some who you don't want to do work with. This is like a genuine, you know, nice homeowner in a nice neighborhood, and they fit your ideal candidate profile. You want this job, but they want to do it for less and you want to keep it there. How do they handle that?
The handling it is also diagnosing what you got in your hands. Sorry. And there are some people, they just wired to, you know, they want to test you.
Yeah.
They want to see if they're not going to be happy with the price if they haven't tested a little bit. They're happy to pay. They want to make sure that you're not coming in high just for the hell of it. Then there's the people that just don't have the money.
Right.
You know, so are they testing you, or are they being genuine with you? You need to know which one of those two are in order to make your decision. All right. So how do you diagnose it? You know, the labels are the diagnostics. And so if somebody's pushing back on price, the first thing is, well, if the price is wrong for the other side, it's really an issue of value for them. Mm. And so a label can be, it just sounds like the value is just not there for you. Their reaction to that, you know, no, it's there for me. I just don't have the money.
Right.
All right. So that's the beginning of an indicator. Or it's, yeah, no, it's just not worth it for me. That's another thing for you to analyze. Or, yeah, you know, it's there for me. You know, I just want to see if I can get a better price.
You know, look, that's a very important, data to gather. Like you're going to play your cards incredibly differently based on what kind of response you get when you give that label, right. Aren't you?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, that's the one change really in negotiation. And I love the phrase, play your cards. What you're trying to do is get the other guy to show you his cards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what are the possibilities? Or, you know, maybe they think that you're overpriced because the job looks easy. It's a different label. Sounds like you think this is an easy thing to do. Mm.
Let me walk you through how it's not again. Yeah, I think we've all, a lot of our listeners will have been in that situation where you hear a client who's just, well, you know, I could do it myself. And it's like, well, could you? Why am I here then? Listen, we're almost out of time. I want to be respectful and get you out of here on schedule. But I want to, here's a nice closing question, I think. We've talked about a bunch of tactical stuff, tactical empathy, illusion of control, driving hard bargains, Ackerman model, etc. Let's go sort of philosophical again, kind of high level. I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to frame it this way. There's a spectrum, okay? On one end of the spectrum is your cheap, hard-driving, hard who always gets everything they want, but is kind of known that way, and they kind of maybe have the reputation of being that cheap, hard. There's the soft pushover on the other end of the spectrum, who is really nice and loved by all, and people want to be friends with him, and he want to be friends with everyone else. But he, you know, he leaves a lot on the table. How do we, because of my sense of it, correct me if I'm wrong, but we kind of want to do the tightrope walk in the middle.
Right.
How do we do that in life? We want to get what's ours, but we don't want to be a dick all the time. We also want to be liked, but we don't want to be a pushover. That's a tricky thing to do. So what's your advice for business owners to do that in their business and in their life?
Yeah. All right. So how do we balance being the biggest jerk in the room with being the biggest pushover in the room? And if I may, before I answer that, I want to tell people about my documentary.
Yeah, please.
All right. So it's just out on Amazon. It's called Tactical Empathy. And it's a documentary of some of the pretty interesting hostage negotiation cases that led to the development of the Black Swan method. And then we've got some examples of training in it. And then, you know, there's some making the world a better place issues in it too. So it's on Amazon. And what I would offer is anybody that watches it, it's going to, whether you rent it, and I think it's 99 cents to rent, it's $4, $5, you want to buy it, send us an email showing that you rented it, you watched it, info@blackswanltd.com. Put in the subject line, Tactical Empathy Documentary. And we'll give you a $50 credit to any of our online training. Live online, not the recorded stuff, live online. It's a way to stick your toe in the water. It's a minuscule amount of money. It's a 10x rate of return on a small amount of money, so it's not a big deal. But we'd love it if you watch it and let us know you watched it.
What's it called?
Tactical Empathy.
On Amazon.
Is the name of it. It's on Amazon.
Out now.
Yeah. It's out there now. It's getting a lot of great reviews. Reviewing it is a little like Lyft, you know, the Lyft, if you give your Lyft driver anything less than a 5-star review, you're kind of hurting them. Mm. You don't have to review it to get the credit. We just love for you to watch it. If you feel like it, if and only if it's worth it, only if it's worth it. Be grateful for us 5-star review, but that's not necessary to get the credit. We just love for you to watch it. It's entertaining. It's about an hour. You know, introduce you a little bit to the origins of this method. Mm. And then getting back to, you know, how do you walk the spectrum between the biggest jerk in the room and the biggest pushover in the room? Start out, and each one of those are complementary skills. So you want to be able to stand your ground. That's necessary. You want to be able to assert your position gently, quietly, inoffensively. And so the biggest pushover in a room has got a great demeanor. They smile. They use a great tone of voice. They hear you out. They let you talk. The biggest pushover, the biggest jerk in the room, they stand their ground. It's not that they stood their ground. It's how they did it. So, yeah, you need to stand your ground. You just don't need to yell at people and kick chairs across the room when you do it for dramatic effect. Because, yeah, that does get you a great deal short term. And when your reputation gets around, there are fewer and fewer people that are willing to come to the table with you.
It's a very short-term perspective to be overly excited about getting a deal all the time. You're not seeing how that, you're not seeing the longitudinal effect over decades or multiple decades of being in business. I mean, all of our listeners have a small business in their local community that they care deeply about, that they want to grow. There are homeowners, business owners, vendors, realtors, other business people in the space, all of whom they're negotiating with all the time. And they're going to need those relationships to be intact and be in good shape for quite a while yet. And so I think it's a really great analogy. You kind of you don't want to blow it all in one shot for one deal, because there's going to be hundreds of deals on the other side of this. And you want to be in good shape for those too.
Well said.
Yeah. Chris, I really appreciate your time. I'm pumped about this documentary. I didn't even know about this. I'm going to watch it tonight. You guys should too. Thank you so much for doing this, Chris. Have an awesome rest of your day.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.